And welcome back to the SEC on CBS podcast here on CBS Sports. I am your host, Chip Patterson. Dennis Dodd joins me so we can take a spin around the coaching carousel. Breaking news as we were recording, Willie Taggart set to be named the new head coach at Oregon, taking over from Mark Helfrich. We also talk about the college football playoff, what it means for conference championships, and thoughts on who can stop the Alabama Crimson Tide. Make sure that you are subscribed to the SEC on CBS podcast all through the December and January coaching carousel bowl period, and enjoy the Doddcast. Back here on the SEC on CBS podcast, it is a Doddcast edition of the show. We are pleased to be back and at it as we are in the throes of the coaching carousel. We have a college football playoff, and Dennis, you are fresh off an SEC championship game where you got to spend a lot of time with the Alabama Crimson Tide, the number one team in the country. You got to spend some time with Vern Lundquist. So before we really start spinning this thing forward, first thoughts on seeing Alabama, the last undefeated Power 5 team in the country, in person in that dominant win against Florida.
Well, I really think, Chip, they did themselves a lot of good in staying in the top four by winning by 38 against Florida.
the margin
was,
of victory.
That was not my initial takeaway. No, it's, they started the season with 52 points against USC, and they ended the regular season with 54. So it's a net improvement. But, you know, they're a little bit beat up. Two starters out in the secondary. At least one of them will probably be back for the playoff. But it's just getting epic now. It's, you know, Saban is two games away from being the first. Alabama is two games away from being the first 15-0 team in major college football since 1897.
Wow.
I know that's been on their mind. The Penn Quakers. Very quietly, Nick Saban is two games away from tying Bear Bryant for six national championships.
Mm.
And this team shows no let-up. I mean, you can nitpick. The offensive line is a weak spot. Gary Danielson, in a piece I did, raised a good point. Who has tested this secondary this year? And I started to think, in the SEC, no one except Chad Kelly.
For about a half.
So, you know, but who's out there that can test it? I think the only team, before you start talking about who can beat Alabama, you first have to talk about who can move the ball the best against them. And I think that's Clemson, because we've seen it and we know they can. But that's a championship game rematch, which may or may not happen. So we have a long way to go.
The top four, of course, number one, Alabama, number two, Clemson, number three, Ohio State, and number four, Washington. That will be Alabama and Washington in the Peach Bowl. That will be Clemson and Ohio State in the Fiesta Bowl. And Dennis, with Penn State at number five, there are two Power Five conference champions that have been left out. We don't need to dwell on this too much because, unfortunately, or I guess, you know, depending on how you want to view this, a lot of this played out in a way that you and I had predicted leading up to the final announcement, with the idea that conference championships as a criteria, as a way of honoring greatness in college football, the value seems to be plummeting. They seem to be devalued this season more than ever before, particularly from the big swing from where we thought that was where the playoff conversation started.
Yeah, I think it started. Well, obviously, it started with the BCS when we had three of them get in. But I think it started when they wrote the rules for this. I called up the document again that they use for their selection process. And the very first sentence is how to pick the four best teams. And this was written in June of 2012. Now, they've amended it, but this was written the month they adopted the playoff 4.5 years ago. So I'm a little bit surprised that everybody's so surprised.
Right.
because you know, that was their task from the beginning. Now, when you're talking about an Ohio State that doesn't win the Big Ten, that's something else. When you talk about a Penn State that does and has this long tortured heritage of being left out of the number one spot, and in this case the playoff, you can kind of see where it bothers people. But we're way down that road, and it's in an age that you mentioned that conference championships matter less in any given year, your best team can, you know, can easily, you know, finish, in Michigan's case, third in the division. Because I'll just go through this one more time. I mentioned it many times. In the age of the super conferences and 14-team conferences, a league like the SEC, which only plays 8 conference games in any year, and every year in any year, every team is missing 40% of their conference brethren. Now, is that a fair way to decide a conference championship? I don't know. I'm just saying. You don't play 40% of the teams in your league. And it takes, as you know, a period of years to play all of them. So it is what it is. And once people get used to that, the conference championships matter less. The championship games themselves are more about revenue than anything else. I call it commerce over competition. And Roy Kramer started that in 1992 at the SEC. That's the way we're going to go.
Wow. All right, so then we will come back to the playoff, obviously, to get more specific angles and predictions. I like what you said, particularly the one wrinkle that I'll go ahead and throw out there, because it seems like you hinted on it, and it's been my instant response. I do think that Clemson is the team with the best chance to beat Alabama, mm-hmm. but I am not sure that Clemson can get past Ohio State, and that little logic puzzle is probably my favorite wrinkle to this year's playoff.
Yeah. Yeah, I have picked Ohio State because I don't know. I don't think Clemson is as good. I think they're easier to shut down. They got beat at home by Pittsburgh. The defense, I looked it up. The defense numbers are almost identical to where they were last year. And that really surprised me because they've given up some yards and points this year at certain times. They've got All-America quality defensive tackles in there with Wilkins and Watkins, I think. But they're giving up 313 a game this year. They gave up about 313 a game last year. We're going to see in that game, we're going to see a lot of JT Barrett. We're going to see a lot of Tyquan Lewis coming off the edge. And they're going to have a spy on Deshaun Watson, who I think this is the tipping point in the game. You remember how much he gouged Alabama last year. They really had no answer for him running.
Right.
Basically, either the free space to throw or flat out design runs or scrambles. That's the difference in this game. Look at his running stats. They're way, way down from where they were last year. I think he was a 1,400-yard rusher last year. For whatever reason, he doesn't want to run more. They don't want him to run more. They want him to work on his pocket passing. He's just not running, and I think that plays into a team like Alabama, if they play them, and certainly a quality defense like Ohio State.
On one side in the Clemson-Alabama matchup, I think that Clemson has the defensive front. You just mentioned Wilkins and Watkins out there, Dexter Lawrence and Cleland Farrell into that mix. This is just a scouting thing. I think that they've got the athleticism on the defensive front to copy LSU's game plan for shutting down Jalen Hurts. On the other side of the ball, in the first matchup, I look at an incredibly versatile Ohio State defense that just pounces all over poor decisions. And Deshaun Watson, who has thrown a lot of interceptions this season. You just mentioned that Pittsburgh game. Yeah. 3 interceptions in that Pittsburgh game, including one in the end zone. You know, that's where it's like if Deshaun Watson can take care of the ball in the Ohio State game, then I think he presents he is a better challenge or a better suited foe for Alabama than JT Barrett, but I'm not sure if he's going to get there.
Yeah, here's the other thing I forgot to mention as well. Clemson as a whole is not running the ball as well.
No.
You saw, I think the best example is the Pittsburgh game where they had to throw 70 times and because they couldn't run the ball effectively. So, you know, I think you're going to have to be somewhat balanced in whoever you play, but Clemson finished 6th in the ACC this year in rushing, way less than 200 yards a game. And last year they were up at 223. So that's about what? That's about 50 yards a game difference. So they're just not as efficient. Their quarterback, who has been called the best dual threat quarterback in the country, simply isn't running the ball as he has. And you can bet that Ohio State will drill down on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'll be fantastic. And one final note, you know who wasn't in the playoff last year, Dennis? It's Mr. Michael Williams.
Oh, wow. Was Deion Cain?
Nope, he was suspended.
Well, there you go. So we should talk about that for 1 minute, because Michael Williams, a lot of, that I've run across, a lot of people think is the best receiver in college football. Forget about All-American teams. Forget about pro potential.
He's just the best.
The best. Yes, yes. He's going to end up on some All-American teams. And Deion Kane is the speed guy who, first of all, how many teams have that guy who can catch in space down the field? And he does. And he's very, very good. It's kind of like they have that. I don't want to call Mike Williams a short guy, because he's not. He's all over the field. But Deion Kane is your home run hitter, and he may be the best in ball.
Well, Mike Williams is a classic NFL possession receiver who's bigger, stronger, and better at catching it than every defensive back who's guarding him.
Right. He can use that body as a shield. You know, wall off guys like you do for rebounds in basketball. So, you know, that's – but again, you still need that balance.
You need the balance, no doubt.
So we shall see.
We shall see. All right. I was eating my oatmeal, looking around, thinking that I understood everything that was going on the other side of the country in the Pacific Northwest. But a little bird, Dennis Dodd, told me a while ago that that to keep an eye on South Florida's Willie Taggart. It appears that Willie Taggart, as we are recording this here on Wednesday morning, will be named the head coach at Oregon. Your thoughts on what might have been behind this hire? The popular talking point for a lot of this was, of course, PJ Fleck. Now, I'll attribute much of that buzz to the fact that Western Michigan played this weekend, and the South Florida Bulls, though they tied for the division title at 10-2, they did not play for the conference championship. Broncos, obviously, 13-0. PJ Fleck, incredibly charismatic. Row the boat, you know, coal turns into diamonds with pressure. Watch me reach my hand into the bucket and pull out a diamond. You're all diamonds. I mean, you know, all of the enthusiasm and charisma that Fleck brings. I think that you've got an equally charismatic figure in Willie Taggart, maybe one that just wasn't garnering the same type of national attention. What do you think powered this move for Oregon to decide on the former Western Kentucky quarterback, the longtime student of Jack Harbaugh?
Well, I think he's very solid, and sometimes solid isn't sexy, but for the guy who's going to be the guy, the next iteration of the Oregon coach, I think he's perfect. He's a tireless recruiter. He was Jim Harbaugh's running backs coach back in the day at Stanford, but he was more than that. He was more of a right-hand man. I remember writing about him, and Harbaugh couldn't stop talking about the guy. You know, really a running backs coach? No, he was a very good recruiter. And now, 7 years as a head coach, you know, where are you going to find that? You know, you're not going to find that with Lane Kiffin. You know, he hasn't been a head coach for 7 years. He's been a head coach, but not for 7 years. This guy's been at Western Kentucky, did well there, goes to South Florida, which whoever gets that, by the way, that thing's about ready to blow up and become the next, I don't know, Houston, if you will. They've got great facilities there and succeeded. He had the poor man's Lamar Jackson this year and Quentin Flowers, the quarterback who I think returns, I'm pretty sure he returns, and whoever falls into that is going to be great. All that being said, Chip, the Oregon job is going to be extremely hard because the standard there is Chip Kelly. And you're never going to have Chip Kelly again, whether you have him in the flesh or not, because it was lightning in a bottle. It was one of those times it was like the Beatles on tour. You know, you were never going to see that again, and they were only on tour for a short time. I just compared Chip Kelly to the Beatles. But he brought an innovative offense, tireless energy, he recruited like a madman to Eugene, Oregon. He was the perfect face for a university and a brand, which was Nike. I think Camelot has passed at Oregon. It doesn't mean they can't win Pac-12 championships. It does mean it's going to be a lot harder when you strip everything down and when you're not sending players to the pros, when you're not winning Heisman trophies, you're still recruiting to Eugene, Oregon. As I talked to someone yesterday, they reminded me, it's a good point. You know, look at the North Division, Washington State, Washington, Stanford. Those schools aren't going away. They have coaches that are entrenched there that are very, very good. And you're still going to have to go down to L.A. after whatever it was, a 4-8 season, and convince kids that they need to leave Southern California and come to Eugene. You know, that's where it starts. All that being said, I think if there is a guy that can do it and keep it going, it's Willie Taggart. You know, I think it's fantastic. It's great for the movement, which I call it. You know, I think there are now 12 African American coaches in FBS, and this is another minority at a top program. We lost one with Charlie Strong at Texas, but you know, great for the movement that a minority gets a chance at this. But boy, I tell you, that's not the first thing I think of with Willie Taggart. I just think of him as a hell of a football coach.
Well, he your note about Stanford, he was the running backs coach for Toby Gerhart during his incredible season with the Cardinal. And on the note of recruiting, and this was something that I've included in my just this morning trying to gather as much information, put together my thoughts, his major responsibility as the recruiter at Stanford was trying to convince kids from Florida, Georgia, the entire Southeast to come up to Stanford. So this is a challenge. This is a task that, granted, he was only there for two seasons. It's something that he has gotten used to. But, man, it's a fascinating spot. I like, you know, I think back to the South Florida, Florida State game this year and plenty of Bulls games from the last two seasons. I mean, South Florida would go hang 50 points on you. I mean, they could score in bunches. And I think that this is a awesome fit and a good hire for Oregon, but I am with you in that it will be impossible to consider Chip. I don't know if any program is going to see the incredible peak that Chip Kelly experienced with, I think it's four straight 11 win seasons or better, three straight top five finishes, and then out. And then gone. Poof. He's a gone.
And then, three BCS bowls, a national championship run. You know, I think LaMichael James, runner-up in the Heisman. You know, when are you going to see that again at Oregon? Maybe you do. Maybe this is it. You know, maybe Willie Taggart retires at Oregon. Because they are going to give him every possible advantage to win. I mean, we all know about the facilities. At the end of the day, it's going to have to take down, you know, get down and recruit. I mean, you can have all your teak wood, you know, in the facility, wood that neither burns nor floats. I love that one. They actually have that in the facility. Wood that neither burns nor floats.
What good is that?
I don't know. You could, it sounds good. But again, it's going to go around recruiting, but he does have West Coast ties, so he knows a little bit of that.
What do you think of Matt Rhule to Baylor? Is this zig then zag move part two?
Well, as I wrote yesterday or earlier this week, Oregon not only was interested in Matt Rhule, they offered him.
Ooh.
And Phil Knight offered him, as a matter of fact, and he turned it down. I can't explain why he turned down Oregon for Baylor, except that Baylor, as much as they're up to their elbows in the scandal, it is a ripe recruiting area. You don't have to leave the state to get your recruiting class every year. It's going to take some building there. And look, there's a lot of guys that want to be there. There's a lot of guys that want to coach in Texas. And maybe he's looking at Oregon like I just told, you know, a bit of a cement ceiling above your head. Like, it's going to take a while to get this thing turned around because of the standard. You know, what's the standard at Baylor? The standard at Baylor is competing for a Big 12 title. You know, in both schools, Oregon and Baylor, it's kind of lightning in a bottle. For about 6 years, Art Briles had it going. For four, Chip Kelly had it going. I mean, we'll find out, you know, when one of us talks to Matt Rhule, we'll find out why he turned it down. But for now, I think that's a really, really good hire at Baylor. I called around yesterday and people had nothing but good things to say about him. Look, if he can take Temple to a conference championship, think what he can do at Baylor. Now, the problem at Baylor is, you know, you're looking at two wiped out recruiting classes. I think it's pretty known that they have one commit for 17 in their class. Now, that'll change now that they have a head coach. And if the NCAA doesn't come in there, and I don't think they will, then, you know, you're free and clear to build this thing back up.
Do you think that he will try to, you know, I look at the commitment that Baylor is making to him. I think it's a 7-year deal. I look at Matt Rhule maybe seeming like a fish out of water, former Penn State player, a lot of Northeast ties, but he steps in here and I don't see a Matt Rhule coach team. Now, I could be wrong. I mean, we saw Charlie Strong open it up and go wide everything in Texas this year, but I wonder if Baylor fans are going to have to remember what a fullback is. You know, is this?
I don't think so. I was told yesterday that he'll run anything. Now, you know, in the Big 12, I think culturally you have to run the spread,
right?
Because your defense needs to practice against it every day, and that's what kind of players are available to you in Texas. And frankly, you're not going to be able to recruit very well if you're running a pro style in the Big 12. That's my opinion. There may be some hybrid of that I'm not thinking of that he does, and may in fact have fullbacks on the roster. I remember Missouri never did in the Big 12, and they would run out of the shotgun from the 1-yard line. You know, maybe Matt Rhule's different.
That's I hate to turn this into, you know, Dennis and Chip's little football fantasy talk here, but I wonder if at Baylor, you know, not a traditional power at all, you know, Art Briles came in there and was a pioneer and was revolutionary and opened this thing up.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be interesting if Baylor again took a turn, but instead it was the pendulum swinging the other way and Baylor's identity changes a little bit and it becomes tough because it's not what you see in the Big 12. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think,
maybe. I think that's a great, that's probably a great story. And that's a great question to get a hold of. You just gave me a story idea. Get a hold of Matt Rhule right away. But he is from that school. You know, he played linebacker at Penn State under Joe.
Yep.
And, you know, you saw what they ran at Temple.
At Temple, they just want to stop the run. I mean, they would sell out to stop the run and say, you know what, we think it is D'Antonio-esque. You know, I've heard D'Antonio give lectures at coaching clinics, and he'll say all day, he says, look, you know, people were, and this was when Narduzzi was there, this was a couple years ago, I was listening to him speak, and he said, everyone wants to talk about the no-fly zone, but our entire defensive philosophy is that if you can't run the ball on us, you're not going to beat us. And I kind of felt the same way looking at the Owls, and man, that would be a force. If, again, this could end horribly, but that would be a unique story for sure.
Do you remember Trevor Maticavich last year?
Yeah, absolutely.
Temple won, I don't know, some you know, best linebacker awards all over the place. He was the only player in the country who led his team in tackling every game. You know, think about that. That's hard to do. Where, in other words, to me, it sounded like everything was funneled towards him.
Right.
And he was more than willing to accept it. So, yeah, I mean, look what Alabama does. They want to get you one-dimensional, and we're not telling any secrets here, so they can tear your quarterback's head off. But yeah, if you can do that against Oklahoma and you're Baylor, you know, for example, with Mixon and Perine, you know, you got your chances improve a lot because those guys run it pretty well.
As you start to look around at the rest of the pieces in the coaching carousel, there's still a Les Miles out there. There's still Lane Kiffin, who I'm assuming you just spent time around the Crimson Tide. Is the popular assumption still that at the end of this season, whether it's before or after the playoff, Lane Kiffin will be elsewhere next season?
Yeah, I mean, I think at least at LSU as an offensive coordinator, but I get this vibe that Nick wants him out as a head coach because he doesn't want him bringing the company secrets to Ed Orgeron in the same division. I get that.
Makes, you know, total sense.
He could have told Jimmy Sexton, you know, hey, forget that. Get him a head job somewhere. And now he hasn't gotten Oregon. He's in the mix for USF, and various sources have identified him as the top target. He didn't get Houston, although Houston's still open. He did interview well there. I take that back. He is in the mix at Houston, but as I reported yesterday, it looks like they're trending towards the Oklahoma offensive coordinator, Lincoln Riley. 33 years old. So then it just comes down to USF and Charlie Strong, the candidate there, Lane Kiffin, Greg Schiano, who's trying to get a job after a 1 year internship at Ohio State. So we'll see. I'm not quite sure which direction they want to go. You know, they've got to keep this thing going. They've got something going pretty good.
So are things going to calm down because the Indiana job still is open?
The Indiana filled with their defensive coordinator
permanently. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wow. They moved him in. Yeah. He's the guy.
Oh, well, sorry. Yeah, I was already moved on to Indiana basketball.
That's okay.
So have Indiana fans, I'm sure. Yeah. So where's the going to be a big surprise hire or something? Because I felt like we haven't had the domino effect in this coaching carousel yet.
We still have Cincinnati. And I spoke to someone there yesterday. I don't know which way they're going to go. They're not going with PJ Fleck. PJ Fleck, according to a source, told them that he wants a Power 5 job and he won't even speak to Cincinnati. And I get that. Look, yeah. he's at a group of five now, and I don't know what coaching at Cincinnati gets him up the ladder that much. I don't know which way they're going, but you know, two teams in the same conference, in the same league, not going after the same people. It looks like, because I was told Charlie Strong is on the list at Cincinnati, but he's not a top candidate.
Mm. Wow. It just seems too quiet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not, you know, it's, yeah, they're going to have to get everything done by, let's see, Monday is the JUCO signing day. So, you know, you kind of have to get that in place. The dead period is coming up. So if you don't have a coach by the dead period, I think it's the 16th. Don't hold me to it. Then you go through a week there where you can't do anything. So you better have a coach in place who can start recruiting pretty darn quick.
Or, okay, I got you. Yeah. What are in any reason at all to believe that Lamar Jackson will not win the Heisman Trophy?
No.
Yeah.
He tried to give it away. I think he's made the vote closer, but look, I think body of work, 51 touchdowns, 8 touchdowns against Charlotte, to set an NCAA record or tie it, I think. I think if you consider all that, you look at him, he was the best player in college football this year. The last game against Kentucky was bad. He had 4 touchdowns and 4 turnovers, basically lost the game for them. But he was a transformative figure, I think. You know, an arm like Cam, a running ability, an arm like Vic, running ability like Cam, and was a good kid. I think he'll be a fine winner of the Heisman.
When I saw five finalists, that especially knowing that, you know, you have to get 3, but then within a certain percentage point get some tagged on, it almost led me to believe that there's a big gap between either 1 and 2 or at least 2 and 3 to see 5 names on there, because I don't know what the separation is between a Baker Mayfield, Jabril Peppers, yeah, Dede Westbrook, for example.
Well, the number of invitees for the finalists really has to do with the voter breakdown. They've told us that in the past. In other words, you know, you want to get everybody, and it's their decision, the Heisman Trust decision, totally subjective. So I wouldn't think that the number 5 guy is going to get 5%, you know, whoever that is, whoever is it, the Jabril Peppers or whoever's the number 5 guy on
that
list.
It's got to be Peppers.
Yeah, yeah. So two through 5 is what they're telling us was fairly close, and they all deserved a trip to New York. I will add a couple of things real quick. If you're going to pick an all-purpose guy, as much as I love Jabril Peppers, and I blew him out halfway through the season about everything he did, his last 4 games, his performance was not good as an all-purpose guy. And if you want to nitpick, go back and look at the film of Curtis Samuel, the game-winning touchdown against Michigan. He completely overruns that play and almost creates a lane there where he goes in for the touchdown in overtime. Again, not the nitpick, great player.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is, if you're going to pick an all-purpose guy, it has to be a Dory Jackson from USC. just had a better, more impactful year overall, if you're going to pick a Heisman finalist in that space. And also, two from Oklahoma, really?
Yeah.
You know, the last time – here's all you need to know about that.
It was Reggie, time, right?
Yeah, 2004. Two teams, Oklahoma and USC, each had a pair. Matt Leinart, Reggie Bush, Jason White, and Adrian Peterson. Those are four Hall of Famers, so I get that. I don't know if Baker Mayfield and Dede Westbrook are Hall of Famers. And if you're going to put two from Oklahoma on, don't you have to put one of those Alabama defenders on there? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Jonathan Allen? No doubt.
So I thought, but again, it's the voters. And I've said it for years. I don't think as a whole, Heisman voters are very educated about college football. You know, I'll say it again, the sports writers, and I don't have a vote, I think have the most, have the smartest and most informed opinion on how to pick those players. But I think there's a lot of guys who are given votes because they were friends of friends and don't even watch the game, and that's how you end up with this group of finalists.
It's a popularity contest.
Yep.
Mm. That's why the only thing that I can do, Chip Patterson does not have a vote, is just scream as many mildly intelligent college football opinions into the void and hope that they stick with voters.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I got. That's all I can do.
No, it was almost like Jabril Peppers became a trendy pick. Well, by the time people got on to him, he started to decline. You know, before the Ohio State game, his last three games, he'd had 15 touches for 112 yards and a total of 15 tackles. So he wasn't great. He's a fantastic talent. Michigan lost two of its last three games. And again, Adoree Jackson, on the other hand, finished with a flourish. You know, you saw what they did.
And then they finished as one of the hottest teams in the country, and he was certainly a big part of that. Adoree Jackson, he was on my Heisman five that we submit that doesn't count for anything. But hey,
yeah, I can see that. I'm just talking about getting an invite. I thought that I was really surprised he was in that group. I'll put it that way.
Mm-hmm. He is Dennis Dodd. You can follow him on Twitter at Dennis Dodd CBS. Dennis, thank you so much for your time. We're going to catch up next week, and who knows what jobs will be filled, but the one thing that I'm fairly certain on is that Lamar Jackson will be our Heisman Trophy winner.